Folks, if I may have your attention, first I want to thank you for coming out today. Today we have with us Joel Bainin, professor of Middle Eastern history at Stanford University. His writing and research focuses on Egypt, Palestine, Israel, political Islam, and U.S. policy in the Middle East. And today he'll be giving us a presentation on worker struggles in the Middle East in the Arab Spring.
Is there any? Thank you all for coming. I don't think this mic is on. Maybe someone will come and put it on soon. So I'm going to try to project my voice, but I'm usually not able to do it adequately. So if you're in the back and you can't hear, there are seats up front. If I stand up, I'm not going to be able to see my notes, and that'll be even worse.
That mic is for a radio station.
Okay. Okay, so I'm going to talk about, I think it's altogether 5 points. One, I'm going to talk about the neoliberal economic restructuring of the Middle East and how that has affected working people. Two, I'm going to talk about various forms of popular resistance to that process. And I'll focus primarily on Egypt because that's what I know about, and it's also the largest Arab country and the place where there has been the most resistance. But there's some things to say about other places as well. I'm going to talk about the role of gender and women workers, which has changed in the last several years and is important. Then I will talk about workers and the politics of the 2011 Arab uprisings. So, yes, it works. All right. So, again, the slide is about Egypt, but broadly speaking, from the mid-1970s on, the United States government, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank teamed up to try to dismantle the various authoritarian populist economic regimes in the Middle East. So in Egypt and Algeria, it was called Arab socialism. In Syria and Iraq, the Ba'ath Party. But also countries that were never radical in any way or form, Tunisia, Morocco, Jordan, had large public sectors, and there was pressure put on all of these countries to dismantle those public sectors, to cut back government investment in the public sector, to cut back government budgets, because the budgets were typically in default. That translated almost directly into reduction of health services, educational services, all sorts of public services that were provided at a fairly reasonable level to large proportions of the population in several Arab countries. That project envisioned that these countries would specialize in things that they could export rather than try to be self-sufficient. So, for example, Egypt today imports more than 50% of the wheat that it uses to make bread. The typical export industry has become subcontracting for ready-to-wear clothing companies in Europe. So typically, cloth is imported. Even in Egypt, where cotton is grown, cloth is imported. The factories are set up in special economic zones where the investors don't pay full rate of taxes, where trade unions are either prohibited from organizing, or if they're linked to the state, like the Egyptian Trade Union Federation, they don't go in there and organize. Sometimes the working conditions are actually not bad, better than a local factory, but sometimes they're pretty horrific. And in any case, there's no workers' voice, so there's no way for workers to negotiate with their employers over wages or benefits or work hours or work rules or anything like that. It's all top-down. And if the boss is a nice guy, or more importantly, if they are subcontracting for a more or less socially conscious a foreign firm, then the situation will be reasonable. So Levi's, for example, requires its suppliers to be, in local terms, decent, and therefore they are. But other supplier, other outlets, The Gap, JCPenney's, all of these kinds of places don't intervene in that way. So you have whatever the market will bear. So in these textile subcontracting factories, it's quite common to have a high proportion of women because they are thought to be docile. Because they are not thought to be the main breadwinners of their family, although in many cases they are, so therefore they can be paid less. And in one factory that a student of mine wrote her PhD thesis about, they actually have work rules that say that women can be hired if they are no older than 25 years old, if they are not married, if they weigh less than 70 kilos. And the point of this is to have young women who can be physically dominated by big, burly foremen. I don't know of any other place that has done this in quite such an awful way, but this does exist, and the thought is common. So if we focus on Egypt, then the process began right after the 1973 war. President Sadat began to articulate what he called the open door policy. Nothing much happened until after the 1991 Gulf War. Egypt lined up with the United States in that war. And as a reward, 50% of Egypt's economic aid was 50% of Egypt's foreign debt was slashed. And that made it possible for Egypt to sign an economic reform and structural adjustment package with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, with the approval of the United States and the Paris Group, which is another big lending group. And consequently, legislation was immediately enacted to begin to seriously privatize elements of the public business sector. 314 public sector enterprises were slated for privatization. And then as that was going on, workers began to resist. There were strikes and so on. And finally, in 2003, the Trade Union Federation, which is an arm of the state and therefore was playing both sides of the fence, agreed to this unified labor law, which allowed strikes in principle, although in fact there have only been two legal, and also allowed, and this is the most important, and this is again typical in all of the countries where these things are going on, short-term contracts without social rights. So what does that mean? In the Middle East, it's typical for, and in Europe too for that matter, it's typical for workers after a certain trial period, which could be as long as a year, to have what is equivalent to tenure for university professors, that they can't be dismissed unless they have done something really awful. So many workers were happy to work, especially in the public sector, for lower wages because they had job security. And this was especially good for women because women would get child care leave, or if their child was sick, they would get the day off to take care of them or whatever. So that is a shrinking proportion of the kind of employment that's available. More and more, there are limited term contracts, which means the employer can sign a contract with you to work for a day, a week, a month, a year. And then when that contract is up, the employer can either fire you or hire you again. And when you're on a contract like that, you don't have the right to join a trade union, even if one exists, and you don't have the right for any to receive any kind of social benefits. So the countries besides Egypt, which are considered the stars by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank in implementing these kinds of new labor laws and deregulating capital, are Tunisia, Morocco, and Jordan. But Sudan and Algeria have also done many of these things. In Egypt, in July 2004, a new government was installed, headed by Prime Minister Ahmed Nazif. It was called the government of businessmen. All of the economic portfolios in the government were held by cronies of Gamal Mubarak, former President Mubarak's second son, his younger son, all people who were CEOs of multinational corporations or who had received PhDs in economics at Western universities. Some of them even had dual citizenship, which normally speaking would be a big deal. So this government almost immediately began to increase the pace of privatization of public sector firms. That meant more workers were without a job, their economic policies led to increase in the rate of inflation, as you can see here. It was fairly stable at a reasonably low rate until 2004, but when this new government came in, it immediately, the rate of inflation began to go upward. You can also see on this slide some of the gross economic factors that impelled the uprising of 2011 at the economic level. So not only did inflation soar in the second half of 2010 in particular, that's because of the ban on Russia exporting wheat, and Russia is a big wheat grower, and also the increased price of oil, so that raises that translates into higher cost of fertilizer and higher cost of agricultural production in general. So the immediate response of workers in Egypt was to accelerate a wave of strikes that had begun in 1998. But if we go back one or two decades, this was in fact not new. In Tunisia in 1978 and 1984, there were big general strikes and riots. In Gafsa, which is in the southwest of Tunisia, and that's where the phosphates are mined, and this is one of Tunisia's major exports, its major heavy industrial export, it is still a publicly owned phosphate mine. As many as 20,000 people worked there at one point. They're down to 8,000 now. In 2008, the whole region was mobilized because the trade union, the top officials of the trade union in cahoots with the government, were seen to be distributing new jobs on a nepotistic basis. The whole area rose up. Facebook pages were dedicated to this. Demonstrations happened in the coastal cities of Tunis and Sfax. There were demonstrations of Tunisian emigres in the French embassy in Paris and in the French consulate in Montreal. The government had to shut down the internet for a day in order to stop the Facebook and the really, really brutal repression in the fall of 2008, finally put this thing to an end. And this was a dress rehearsal for what happened in Tunisia in December 2010, the self-immolation of Mohamed Bouazizi. It's exactly in that region of Tunisia where Sidi Bouzid is in the Gafsa mining basin. So Tunisia is also very clear. Workers responded to the intensification of neoliberal transformation of the country. In Morocco, too, there were strike waves and riots in the 1980s, again in the late 1990s to 2000. So lot of working class-based unrest in Morocco. Morocco is a strange case because there are actually 17 trade union federations, so their biggest problem is getting them to all work together, and they don't usually do that. Bahrain is important, but also exceptional to the whole thing, because in Bahrain there hasn't been a neoliberal transformation of the economy. Bahrain is formerly a big oil and natural gas producer. Now that's very much less, but the economy was this kind of rentier economy based on petroleum, and the issues were rarely the poverty of workers. The issue was more commonly that most workers, because most of the population, are Shia, and most managements, because the ruling dynasty and all of the people around them are Sunni. So there is this constant sense of grievance and oppression, which does translate itself into the labor movement. And the General Federation of Bahraini Trade Unions is actually one of the more progressive ones in the Arab world, because not only do they organize Bahraini workers, but they try to organize migrant workers from South Asia who, by law, are not eligible to join a trade union. They also speak about domestic servants who are often abused and even raped by their employers, and they so they speak out for them. And about 30% of the leadership of the trade unions who belong to the Bahraini Federation of Trade Unions are women. So they're pretty good on gender relations too. So there was this wave of popular resistance, which you can see here. This is a chart that my research assistant, Marie Duboc, who is the one who did the research in the factory that I was telling you about, where they only hire the young women who weigh less than 70 kilos. So she put together most of these numbers, and I added the last couple of years. And what you can see is that beginning in 1998, the number of strikes, sit-ins, and other collective actions began to spike, and it's twice as much per year as it was in any of the previous 20 years. And then in 2004, the year that Ahmed Nazif came in, it's twice as much as it was in the late 1990s. And it continued to grow up through 2010. So that you've got, we don't have good numbers for all the years, but if you extrapolate, it's probably about 4 million workers were involved in strikes, sit-ins, and other collective actions during the 12 years before the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak, and the total number of actions, somewhere between 3,400 and 4,000 actions. These are based on reports in the newspapers, so they're not terribly precise. It's more a ballpark estimate. This continued during and after the overthrow of Mubarak. So this shows you, this is not where we want to go. There we go. No, wait. This shows you, first, this is a slightly different basis for calculating 2009-2010. So again, they're not precise. It's just a ballpark estimate. But more importantly, this shows you that in February of 2011, Mubarak was overthrown on February 11th. So beginning actually on February 8th, in response to a call from the newly established General Federation of Egyptian Trade Unions, I'll talk about that in a minute, there were 489, I think it is, strikes, sit-ins, and demonstrations, probably 300,000 people in 1 month. And if you go forward from then to the end of 2011, where we now have statistics all the way through to the end of 2011, it's about 1.5 to 2 million Egyptian workers have participated in some form of collective action during 2011. So not only were workers an important force in creating pressure that delegitimized the Mubarak regime for the 10 years before Mubarak was overthrown, they were a critical force in the last 3 days and probably a big factor in leading the army to decide that they would push Mubarak aside. Because what actually happened on February 11th was half a military coup and half a revolution. There was a popular movement, a very large popular movement. Workers played a very big role in the popular movement at the very end. And the generals, led by Mohammed Hossein Tantawi, who was the Minister of Defense for 20 years under Mubarak, pushed him aside and said, okay, we are now assuming the role of the presidency collectively. So what kind of revolution is that if the former Minister of Defense is now running the country? For that reason, exactly, you've had the continuation of workers' collective actions and also all sorts of other political mobilizations in an effort to follow through on what the generals promised, which was to let the revolution achieve its demands. Okay, so a little bit more detail on how this came about. And it's really Egypt, Tunisia, and to a somewhat lesser extent, Morocco, where this particular version of things is valid. So Ghazal al-Mahalla, which is Misr Spinning and Weaving, is the largest textile spinning and weaving and clothing manufacturing conglomerate in Egypt. It's the biggest factory in Egypt. It's the biggest factory in the entire Middle East. Employs about 25,000 workers. It was it's the first mechanized spinning and weaving factory established in Egypt in 1927, and it was also one of the first factories to be nationalized by Gamal Abdel Nasser. So, beginning the era of Arab socialism. So, this place has enormous political and practical symbolic weight in the country. And typically, whatever happens there has ramifications at least throughout the textile industry and sometimes beyond. So in December of 2006, the workers went on strike, and it was the women who more or less incited the strike. They had been promised that instead of receiving their end-of-year bonus that would be equivalent to 200 Egyptian pounds, which would translate into about $40 or thereabouts, they were promised 2 months, two full months of pay. So that would be a very big difference, because 2 months of pay, that would work itself out to be closer to $200. So they didn't get it, and the month before, in November, there were national elections for trade unions throughout Egypt, and the security services simply disallowed about 10,000 people from running. So mostly people who were Muslim Brothers, but also leftists or anybody else that the regime couldn't count on. So those people, not only in Misr Spinning and Weaving in Ghazal al-Mahalla, but in many other places, became strike leaders. So workers actually elected people who they couldn't vote for in the formal trade union elections to be the strike committee. And one of the good things that the post-Mubarak government has done is it has annulled those elections, the trade union elections. It's recognized that they were completely fraudulent. So now no one knows exactly who are the trade union leaders. So in this situation, Mohammed Al-Attar is the foreman of one of the clothing manufacturing sections of the company. All the people who work under his supervision are women. And he was encouraging the women over the course of several weeks to act in case they didn't get the bonuses that they were promised, because they were kind of expecting not to get them. And when that happened, 3,000 women marched out of their factory. So this is a huge complex with dozens of different buildings that do different processes, and it's all enclosed by a wall, and you cannot get in, just, you know, reporters or me, you can't just walk in there. So they walked out of their factory, and in the central square of this whole compound, they start chanting, where are the men? The women are here. So they basically embarrassed the men into walking out and joining them. And there was a very sharp strike didn't last very long because they won. It was very straight up that they won because the government was afraid that if they let this thing run out for a long time, it would lead to broader civil unrest. So here are two people, friends who of mine, who played an important role in that strike, Muhammad Al-Attar on the left, and Said Habib, who is actually, he's the third generation of people in his family who have worked in this factory. So this guy, his grandfather was one of the original workers in the factory in the late 20s and early 30s. So he knows about working class and trade union stuff. So they won this strike in December 2006. They tried to set up an independent trade union coming off of that success. The government understood that it would be terrible if this was allowed to happen, so they smashed it. And they didn't get their actual 2 months bonus, even though the government had promised to give it to them. So they went out on strike again in September 2007. And in 2007, Muhammad Al-Attar and five other members of the strike committee were arrested. And the security forces, the state security investigations, which still changed its name but still exists, pressured them to accept a deal. And they said, no, we can't accept a deal behind the backs of our constituents, but we'll offer it to them and we'll see what they want. And if they take it, it's okay. If they don't take it, then no. So Muhammad Al-Attar is a pretty good speaker. And it was Ramadan, and he went out there and he said, okay, here's the deal. This is what we're being offered. And so do you want it or not? And he said something very important, which most foreign journalists and academics missed entirely. He said, well, work is politics. What we are doing here, this is as democratic as it gets. So he understood that standing in front of probably 9,000 people and asking them to vote, nothing like that had happened in Egypt in 50 years, at least 60 years probably. So they voted no, and 3 days later, the government capitulated and they won. So that was pretty impressive. Then, although they did not succeed in forming an independent union, the real estate tax authority workers, who are state employees, did. They went out on a strike for 11 days in December of 2007. They sat down in front of the Ministry of Finance. The result was a wage increase of 325%. Now, you can imagine how little they were making in the first place, that the government was willing to give them 325% more. So the guy here in the middle is Kamal Abu Aita. He was one of the prominent strike leaders. He was one of the people who the security forces wouldn't let run for trade union office in his trade union. And over the next year, they organized throughout the country. And December 2008, they had the founding Congress of the Independent Real Estate Tax Authority Workers Union, which still exists and has somewhere between 35 and 50,000 members now. So, wrong direction. So, the real estate tax authority workers and teachers and medical technicians were the only places where workers were able to use this strike wave to form an independent organization. But right after Mubarak was thrown out, the Egyptian Federation of Independent Trade Unions was established. So, excuse me, right before. This is January 30th, this demonstration here. And they came to Tahrir Square. No, this is, excuse me, this is February 8th. They came to Tahrir Square. They had a press conference. Kamal Abu Aita was there. Muhammad Al-Attar was there. Kamal Abbas, who's the coordinator of the Center for Trade Union Worker Services, was there. They announced the formation of this new Independent Trade Union Federation. And on February 8th, they raised a demand for a general strike to get Mubarak out. And this is when the big strike wave began. So somewhere 250,000 to 300,000 workers went out on strike to call in response to this call. So that was pretty impressive. Now, if we shift gears to Tunisia, and I don't have slides of Tunisia, something very similar happened. The General Union of Tunisian Workers was in cahoots with the Ben Ali regime, primarily because Ben Ali was opposed to the Islamists, and the trade union movement was also secular. So they made a deal with the devil. We'll support Ben Ali because he's against the Islamists. And anyway, we really basically have no choice, because if we don't support him, he'll crush us. So you had this deal at the top where the trade union supported Ben Ali in corrupt election after another. But at the bottom, in certain sectors, you had a radical local leadership. That was mostly teachers, postal workers, bank clerks. So people who are educated, and Tunisia is far more literate than Egypt. Egypt literacy rate is about 60%, and Tunisia literacy rate is about 85%. So a much better educated society on the whole. So when Mohamed Bouazizi immolated himself on December 10th, 2010, the upper echelons of the Trade Union Federation didn't do anything. But within a day or two, the local trade union offices in the Gafsa phosphate basin, where there had been the big working class upsurge in 2008, were all over it, and they were supporting the movement that was growing, opposing the regime. And finally, towards the very end, the National Trade Union Federation was forced to come along, and they declared a general strike in Tunis, and that was the day that Ben Ali left. So in Tunisia, the state-affiliated trade union federation came in very late, too late to have much of an effect, in fact, but the base was very active. In Egypt, the entire official trade union federation was totally useless from day one till now, and it was these independents who were able to play a big role in the movement at the very end. In Bahrain, just as a contrast, the Bahrain Federation of Trade Unions was always at the vanguard of democratic movements. This has to do with the Shia-Sunni business, that about 65% of the population of Bahrain is Shia, and therefore also most of the working people are Shia, but most of the managers and the elite and the royal family are Sunni. So they were out there also. There was a demonstration called by students and youth for February 10th, 2011. The cops went in and started beating them up. The Trade Union Federation called a general strike to support the youth who were occupying Pearl Square. The government said, oh, no, well, okay, we won't beat them up anymore. So they said, okay, we'll call off the general strike. Then the sit-in in Pearl Square continued. And then finally the Saudis came in March with arms that they had gotten from the United States and their mercenaries, and they brutally attacked the demonstrators. And then the Bahraini Federation of Trade Unions said, okay, we'll call a general strike to protest what the government has done. And 3,500 of them, including a large number of their leaders, were arrested. Some of them have been let out now. The situation in Bahrain is very unstable right now. So this just gives you an idea of the turnaround in Egypt. So this guy with his hand up, Mustafa Basyuni, is a trade union labor journalist, and he belongs to the Revolutionary Socialists, which is a Trotskyist organization. So there he is sitting together with the two main leaders of the independent trade union movement, Kamal Abbas and Kamal Abu Eita, and why is this not doing too well on the bottom there? I don't know. Right next to him is the new Minister of Labor. So the new Minister of Labor is sitting next to the guy from the Revolutionary Socialists who is moderating the panel. So that's not a revolution in and of itself, but that shows you that something big did happen in Egypt. Here are some women which is another big thing that happened in Egypt. So I talked to earlier about the women of Ghazal al-Mahalla. These women worked at this pitiful place, Mansura España, a Spanish-Egyptian joint enterprise. They were making about $40 a month, and the place was going to close. They had a two-month strike in which 85% of the workers were women, so there was a the women were leading the strike. There was a picture on the front page, and this I couldn't find, of the main Egyptian independent newspaper, with not only these women, but women wearing a face veil, arm-in-arm with the men. So what's on their head and on their face had nothing to do with their militance as workers. They were quite there. So what we can say is that in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Bahrain, it is very clear that workers added an important social dimension to the uprising. And the Egyptian slogan captures it best. Bread, freedom, social justice. It rhymes in Arabic. So that's important for political slogans. And that was taken up elsewhere. Much less so in Morocco and Jordan, but also to a certain degree. But in Libya, Syria, and Yemen, not at all. So no workers' presence in the movements there. The greatest success has been in Tunisia, where after having adopted a retrograde stance for most of the time that Zain al-Abidine Ben Ali was in office, afterwards the General Federation of Trade Unions began to move in a progressive direction. Several of their members joined the cabinet. They resigned over protest that members of the previous ruling party were still in the cabinet. And finally, after the trade unionists and others resigned twice, a cabinet free of the previous ruling party was put in place. The previous ruling party, the Democratic Constitutional Alliance, was made illegal. And Tunisia had a pretty democratic election in which the Islamists were overwhelmingly the largest force. Same thing happened in Egypt. And so in Egypt, workers didn't get into the cabinet, but the Minister of Labor, who they nominated, did. But that was much less than Tunisia. And Egypt had also a relatively democratic election, and the Islamists swept the election. So this raises the question, if workers were so present in the movements before the autocrats were overthrown and at the critical moment when they were overthrown, and they continued to be active after the autocrats were overthrown, how come they haven't been able to play a big role in the new regimes that have just been established, especially in Tunisia and Egypt, which are the two places where the workers participated the most? So I don't have a great, simple answer for this, but the beginning of the answer is that workers didn't have an independent organization. So the Independent Federation of Egyptian Trade Unions was only established on January 30th. And so it's a year and a month old. They're not well-rooted. In Tunisia, the General Federation was a partner of the regime. So they had to reorganize themselves. And in Tunisia, they did relatively better. The workers were relatively more prominent in the political arena, were part of the Democratic Poll, which was an alliance of leftist and secularist parties. So Tunisia, relatively better. Egypt, not. A second factor which explains this could be that while the workers were very active, they don't have a political program. They had an economic program. And at the critical moment, they were strongly in favor of ousting the autocrats. But they don't have a political party. There were not workers' parties. So there's going to be, in both cases, a long period of struggle after the overthrow of the autocrats. Things are still in motion, and we don't know yet how this is going to turn out. Thank you.
Folks, we're going to open it up for discussion now, but before we begin, I'd like to point out a couple of things. First, thank you, Joe, for that amazing presentation. We, unfortunately, are limited on time, so I'm going to limit everyone to 2 minutes for comments or questions they'd like to make. If you'd like to say something, please raise your hand and keep your hand raised until I make eye contact with you and point at you so I can write your name on the list. And if you begin approaching the two-minute mark, I will, in a very stern voice, ask you to wrap up. Asad Abu Khalil.
You raised towards the end the crucial question, why did they translate their struggles into political participation after the uprising were achieved? But there's also another question, which is, why is there this paradox? On the one hand, you have all these progressive struggles which were instrumental in the progress of these uprisings against the dictatorships. But on the other hand, the political victors, the Ikhwan and the Farakis, are a bunch of reactionaries who have absolutely no sensitivity to social justice and who clearly are making good deals with the World Bank, IMF, just like with these regimes.
So, in Egypt, which is the place I know best, it comes down to something like this. Many workers voted for Muslim Brothers candidates for the parliament even before the most recent elections, which were relatively free. And they did that for two reasons. One, they didn't want to vote for the ruling party. And two, the Muslim Brothers were really the only serious party. I mean, all the other political parties were worthless. They were jokers in a parliamentary charade. The Muslim Brothers were perceived to be real. They have an organization. They can deliver services, which is important if 44% of the people are living near or below the poverty line. And they are perceived to be not corrupt. Nobody knows what their social program is because they don't articulate one. They this and that, and it's completely unclear what they think about social issues. So they've never come out and said something where a worker's leader could say, aha, see, you really are in league with the capitalists. They are. I mean, there's no doubt that they are. But they haven't said it clearly. And there are factions within, with the youth are actually more progressive. The older guys are pretty awful. So it's unclear what they stand for. The same is true in Tunisia with Ennahda. Al-Ghanouchi, the leader of Ennahda, has made a very big change in what he says politically from the time that he went into exile in the late 80s to London to when he returned this past year. Does he mean what he now says, that he is in favor of democracy and pluralism and they won't coerce anybody to wear headscarves? I don't know. But now he says that. So that makes it very hard for people to call him out on something. So I think that what's going to happen is what's happened in Egypt with regard to the army. It took the better part of a year for a substantial number of Egyptians to learn that the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, which is the ruling force in the country now, is not on the side of the people. People didn't realize that at first. Even people who played a leading role in the revolution, many of them didn't realize that the army is not the way to win this revolution. So similarly, this is going to happen with the Muslim Brothers in Egypt, with Ennahda in Tunisia, perhaps also with the Justice and Development Party in Morocco on social issues. There was a very interesting report in Le Figaro, which is a right-wing French magazine, on the occasion of Zain al-Abidine Ben Ali's fall. That was January 10th, 2011. I just happened to be in Paris that day, and that was the newspaper in the hotel. I opened it up. There's a report. And this clever reporter went not to Tunis, but to the Gafsa phosphate basin and interviewed the people, the working class people who live in the most underdeveloped part of the country. And this one guy says, nothing has changed since the election, which Ennahda won. And if they don't deliver, we voted for them, but we'll also get rid of them.
The man in the black hoodie? Oh,
actually, that answers my question.
Okay. Hannah in the back?
Hey. So I'm interested in terms of what your opinion is as to why we see very, very different situations in Morocco and Jordan than we do in a place such as Egypt. Because you were drawing similarities between the labor structures there. So argument that I've seen most frequently is something along the lines of, well, it's a monarchy in Morocco and a monarchy in Jordan versus a dictator in Egypt. And, you know, there are various arguments as to why that changes the outcome and the level of stability in those different countries. I don't know if you can speak to differences that you see actually in the, like, more nuanced differences in the labor movements that might have contributed to different revolutionary or lack thereof outcomes in those countries.
Okay, so the fact of the monarchy is not the critical thing. It's the fact that there is in both countries a social base for the monarchy. So the ruling dynasty in Morocco claims to be descended from the Prophet Muhammad, and they might actually even be. And therefore, the king, Muhammad VI, has baraka, spiritual powers. And Morocco is a very poor and uneducated country. Illiteracy rate is even higher in Morocco than it is in Egypt. Poverty is even higher in Morocco than it is in Egypt. Rural, uneducated people accept that the king is legitimate because the king has baraka. In the cities, is much less support. In Jordan, you have a similar situation. Jordan, the majority of the population are Palestinians, refugees from 1948 and from 1967. And now you also have Iraqis living in Jordan. The historic social base of the regime is the Bedouin tribes. And the Bedouin tribes know that this is how they're going to keep their privileges and support the monarchy. And, you know, there have been some frictions even in the recent year, past year, between the tribes and the monarchy. But by and large, the monarchy has been secure because it's East bankers, the Bedouin tribes, who have been given the key roles in the army and the security forces and so on. The monarchy has never depended on the Palestinians, even though there are lots of Palestinians over the years who have collaborated with the monarchy. Then there are, in terms of the workers themselves, the fact that there are 17 trade union federations in Jordan, which is in part the work of the monarchy, that they've been very clever at splitting and putting people off one against each other, that makes it difficult to unite. In Jordan, there was no real trade union movement to speak of until about 10 years ago. Once Jordan signed a qualified industrial zone agreement with Israel and the United States, that was in 1994 when Jordan made peace treaty with Israel. They opened these zones where if the finished product has 10.5% Israeli content, whatever it is, labor, capital, technology, materials, then it has duty-free and quota-free access to the United States. Egypt fought against it, but also signed a similar agreement in 2004, I think it is. So workers in those qualified industrial zones are treated like prisoners. And so finally, a trade union movement of some significant proportions emerged. In 2011, there were over 470 strikes and other collective actions in Jordan. So that's tiny compared to Egypt. It's also a much smaller country, but huge compared to what there has historically been. So they are barely getting themselves off the ground organizationally, and they have this other problem that a very large proportion of the workers in these qualified industrial zones are actually Pakistanis and South Asians, and they're not allowed to join a trade union, and they're living in these dormitories, and their employer takes their passports. So all sorts of very oppressive and restrictive conditions there.
Will?
Yes, I read an article not long ago by Samir Amin, who's based in Dakar, West Africa, an Egyptian by background and an academic. He said that there was a coalition of five parties on the left, including two or three socialist parties. Are they, do you know anything about that? Are they projecting a program of some sort which has the potential of really a mass rally?
Honestly, I have to tell you, no. There was an electoral coalition formed, and I think it's still operational, between the Communist Party, which is a historic party, and in fact the party that Samir Amin used to belong to anyway, I don't know if he still does, which was underground under Mubarak and Sadat and Nasser and is now open. There is the Popular Socialist Forces Party. There is a Social Democratic Party. And there are two other parties with socialists or workers in their names. So the Social Democratic Party is not part of that alliance, but all the others are. And then there's the Revolutionary Socialists, who are also not in that alliance, and their party is called the Democratic Workers' Party, and that's because they're not going to get along with the communists. So all of these forces together, except for the Social Democrats, who actually, as a new party, did, given what new parties did in Egypt, not too badly in the elections. They actually won some seats in the parliament. All these parties together couldn't win one seat. Why is that? They've been underground, or they were just formed. It's illegal, according to the Constitution of Egypt, to form a class-based or a religion-based party. So they're always, even now that they exist, they're kind of in a problematic situation. Some of them are super-duper dogmatic, really painfully dogmatic. I say this with real pain in my heart because they're my friends, a lot of these people. And it's going to take them some time to figure out how to operate. I mean, we're not done in Egypt. We've just begun. This is not over. So I'm relatively optimistic. I mean, I think Egypt has a better chance than the United States in the next several years.
The woman in the green shirt? Oh, did you not raise your hand? Let me just pardon you. The man in the yellow jacket in the back?
Are there common characteristics of successful and healthy labor movements?
Yes. Well, if we look just at the Arab world, one criterion for success is an independent organization, an organization that is not controlled by the regime and that actually, whatever it is, puts forward demands that meet workers' needs. More radical, less radical, that's all possible, but an independent organization. That's the key difference between why it is that workers have more of a presence in Tunisia politically now than Egyptian workers, even though Egyptian workers actually contributed a lot more to the overthrow of Mubarak than Tunisian workers did to the overthrow of Ben Ali. Egyptian workers didn't have, until January 30th, any serious independent organization except for these three independent trade unions, which were not coordinating with each other to any meaningful extent. So that's one key thing. Another important thing is the capacity to make alliances with other sectors of the society. And in Tunisia, that was very strong because the most radical elements within the trade union federation were former communists or former Trotskyists or still communists or still Trotskyists, and they knew people in the intelligentsia. In Egypt, workers, by and large, did not. I mean, 40, 100, 200 workers had, in the whole country, I mean, it's a country of 82 million, had some ongoing relationships with radical intellectuals. But that's not enough in a country of that size.
The man in the gray shirt.
You know Egypt well, Joel. Are you optimistic that a true democracy will prevail there any time in the near future?
Well, first, what is a true democracy? is the United States a true democracy? We have some real problems here. In the United Kingdom, they have an established religion. Americans would not tolerate that. This country was established in part to get away from that. So there is a broad range of things which could qualify as reasonably democratic and which would still have problems, I think. As I said, I am reasonably optimistic that things will get much better in Egypt than they are now. Where the end of that will be, I think we can't know. Because, the United States is not going to like that. The United States is likely to intervene or to encourage Israel to intervene. Israel is not going to like it. So the whole region, the whole Arab region, is in the process of being reconfigured now. And all of the pro-American forces have either been removed or are under attack. And this is not over yet. So it's going to be a while before we see what the balance of forces is going to be in the region.
Okay, folks, I just want to mention we're getting pretty close to time, so I'm going to take a last row of hands. And after we finish the stack, I'm going to give it back to Joel to wrap up. Let's see here. I think I saw the woman behind the woman in the purple keffiyeh raise her hand. Yes, you, the one who... Yeah, go ahead. No. You. Uh-huh.
You were at AUC?
Yes, I was at AUC. Did you hear about the strike?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I was just wondering if you did. But our university students, we had to step in and we had to protest with them so the voices were actually heard in the university. Because I was trying to look up the command on my AUC email. I think they were getting like maybe $200 equivalent to US dollars and like for food, just a tiny bit of kosher.
So, but that's actually a very atypical situation. There was no repression against those workers when they went on strike. You know, the university president, Lisa Anderson, very smart cookie, and she knew how to play that very well. Second, there were faculty members like Rabab el-Mahdi who belonged to the Revolutionary Socialists and played a very important role in helping the workers. So there was a case where workers did have links with political intellectuals, and some of them were very helpful. Didn't have to be Trotskyists. I don't want to push that one. These are people I know, so I do know their political affiliations. Samer Suleiman, who is also in the political science department, is one of the leading intellectuals of the Social Democratic Party. He was also playing a good role. So when there are people like that who can not lead, I think it's very important to emphasize, they didn't lead, but they helped workers to articulate their demands and to translate what the workers wanted to the university administration in a language that the administration could understand. And therefore, people got a considerable part of what they wanted. Because American University in Cairo isn't a profit-making business and can't have the reputation that the American leadership of the university is oppressing its Egyptian workers. That just won't work. They know they cannot function like that.
The man in the blue shirt.
Joel, it sounded like, you know, the neoliberalism, the structural reforms in Egypt were something that somebody felt was a good idea, the World Bank, maybe the U.S.
Milton Friedman.
Milton Friedman, we encouraged them, we squeezed them, and so this has been taking place, all the things you mentioned. And I know you're a historian, but maybe even share with you, do people who were thoughtful about it and maybe knowledgeable continue to think that this is the right direction for Egypt and other countries for their economies?
So that's a very good question, and it's not one that I have the answer to, because, in fact, many public sector companies in Egypt were grossly inefficient, badly managed, and undercapitalized. Now, part of the inefficiency was that the government was using employment in those factories as an unemployment program. So it used to be the law that if you graduated high school, the government owed you a job. So they put you in one of these factories, and so you had four or five times as many people manufacturing whatever it was as were actually required. They didn't get paid very much, but they got paid something, and they had access to medical care and so on. So the world market can't work like that, right? You might be able to do that in a socialist universe where the market doesn't rule. But as long as you have to sell your stuff at the world market price, that won't work. The government didn't have the money to recapitalize these places. It's not just that they, as a matter of policy, decided they wouldn't. That is true. They did decide as a matter of policy they wouldn't under pressure from the international financial institutions, but they didn't have the money anyway. They were going to have to borrow it from the IMF, which wouldn't lend it to them for this purpose. So what could they do? They were in a bind. So workers have, in some places which were public sector and which were sold, fought really, really bitter strikes. In one place, the place where they only hire women who are less than 70 kilos, there were 208 strikes in the course of 2 years over the fact that this place was privatized and sold to an Indonesian multinational, and Indian managers were brought in, and they treated the Arab workers like shit. There is just no other way to put it. And people were outraged. And now that place and another flax mill nearby in Tanta and the Omar Effendi department stores and a few other places, especially some of those places were sold to Saudis who were not any nicer than the Indians. They were, if anything, worse. So those places are supposed to be now renationalized. Will they be economically successful if they're renationalized? That's not clear. So in specific cases like that, workers demanded that they be renationalized, and they've won some of them. What kind of economic structure would work for Egypt? I mean, Egypt's a very poor and economically underdeveloped country. Nobody, not even all the smart, Western-educated people with PhDs in economics, has actually come up with a viable plan. I mean, in a way you couldn't until Mubarak was removed. And now there's the IMF and World Bank are continuing to push in their direction. It's not clear. I mean, unless somebody comes up with a plan, there won't be any way to push back. So somebody like Samir Amin, his plan is to go back to Nasserism, but that's not going to work. So that's what I mean about the dogmatism. That there has to be something other than that.
The woman in the back in the black hoodie.
Is there activity around that in unincorporated sectors of the workforce, like, for example, the Zabani, like the garbage collectors, and informal parts of the economy that have had to face, like, multinationals kind of trying to come in and co-opt their already way of organizing?
No. Those people were marginalized in the Mubarak regime. And actually, it's not just Egypt. Everywhere where the neoliberal program has been installed, there has been the growth of what's called the informal sector, but which I think is more properly understood as the structurally marginalized sector. And those people have the least political power. They are participating the least in elections and in other activities. And that grows out of the nature of their work, which is not stable. So it's relatively easy if you have a factory of 20,000 people and 50 good organizers to call a strike. But if you don't even have a stable workforce and they don't come to work in the same place, it's very hard to organize them.
The man in the green and black stripes.
No, no. This is not St. Petersburg, 1917. This is nothing like that. Nothing like that.
The woman in black.
I'm wondering if Gaza's come up, the people trapped in Gaza, and could you speak to that? And I mean,
well, the Egyptian people, generally speaking, hated the fact that the Mubarak regime was complicit with Israel and the United States and Europe in keeping the people of Gaza imprisoned. And the generals, understanding that, announced within a month after Mubarak was gone that they were going to open the border and do all sorts of things, but they haven't done it. The border is somewhat more open than it was, but not for young men. It's somewhat easier to get goods in and out of Gaza, but still sharp limits on things like concrete, so rebuilding has not happened as much as is required. And Egyptians, if you ask them, do they like this, they will say no. Almost all of them will say no. And if you ask them, are you prepared to go out and demonstrate about it? They will also say no, because the Egyptian economy is in the toilet. People feel like they need to work. And so there's this very delicate situation in which it takes real political artistry to move the thing forward. And it won't move forward at all, I don't think, on foreign policy issues. It will move forward on domestic issues that people really feel close to their daily lives, even though people have opinions.
The man in the gray cap.
I guess my question just revolves around the identity of workers within Egypt and where they place maybe some of more of their allegiances to. You talk about kind of the idea that the workers' parties and things like that, are they heavily identified? They identify as workers, and then when they go home, identify as something else, or are they involved in their community in different ways, and where their allegiance lies kind of to that extent? So even if those existed, would they feel inclined to vote for them?
So that's a good question, and I think in Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco, Bahrain, and probably a few other places as well, the word working class actually means something. And if working class appears in the newspapers regularly, even liberal newspapers use it, and people know who workers are, and workers know who they are. And the class differences are very, very sharp, especially in Morocco and Egypt, much more so than here. Here, you walk on the street, you might not be able to tell if somebody is a factory worker, if there still are factory workers, because they might be dressed just like you're dressed. That's not the case in Egypt, in Morocco, and a few other Arab countries. Likely more to be the case in Tunisia. So people know their workers. Other people know their workers. The term is used. Nobody is trying to run away from it. Like in the United States, we always say middle class. No one says working class in the United States. Everybody's middle class. So what about those people who actually are working class? When they never come up as an item of conversation. That's not the case. But people are also very suspicious of intellectuals from Cairo coming to their workplace and telling them what to do, and they don't want it. So it will take a long time for relations of trust to be established. And actually, a guy from the Muslim Brothers once put it very well to me, because they had announced that they're going to establish an independent trade union, and then they didn't do it. So I interviewed him and asked him, well, you know, what's up? You said you were going to do that. And he said, look, workers aren't like students. Students, you can come in and convince them, and they don't have any responsibility, so they'll join up. But workers, they have families, they have responsibilities. You have to show them over a long period of time that you're reliable. Right? Well, so not enough time has even passed for that.
The man in the back in the blue hoodie.
Coming into completely new circumstances and trying to figure out how to organize. And that was one of the things he told me. It's like that there was a whole way they had to operate because of the police state nature where people wanted to get involved.
Who'd you talk to?
Mustafa Omar. Anyways, that's what he described. It's like talking to folks, if you've been involved, I know from experience in our own organization, some inertia that builds up and people are organizing. You can read history and theory, but when reality smacks you in the face, it takes time to learn to organize. And I think that's a process that they're going through and the other groups are going through. I would say that I still think they're probably more advanced than where we are in the United States. I mean, they have at least in the hundreds, if not the low thousands. I don't know exactly what the accurate number, but that's way bigger than the revolutionary left. US. So just wanted to say that, but I guess I did have a question though. In the US, the reason we're weak is a combination of McCarthyism and also the left looking to whether it's Mao or Cuba or Stalinist Russia, varying reasons why the left is so small here. Egypt clearly has like a really rich history, so I was wondering if you could maybe break down why you think the left is smaller. I mean, there's a history of secular nationalism that got crushed. And I don't know the whole history of like the Communist Party in Egypt, but I know in different countries it was very sizable because of its ties to the Soviet Union, Russia, obviously, what I would argue for regular politics. But I was curious if you could maybe touch on
so
the history of the left and why it's in a weaker state.
Actually, there are some pretty comparable reasons for the weakness of the left in Egypt and in the United States over the last 60 years. In the United States, it basically comes down to the fact that the New Deal delivered enough goods for a big enough part of the working class to be acceptable. And you could argue that the Communist Party also didn't maintain its political independence and so on, but fundamentally, the New Deal worked up through the late 60s, early 70s. People's living conditions, wages improved, workers sent their kids to college, I worked in an auto plant in Detroit. My colleagues at work, their kids were going to good universities. They owned summer homes in upstate Michigan. They went hunting and fishing. They had a boat. I mean, they had pretty good life. This is UAW. I mean, we made good money. So people were, it's not that they wouldn't go on strike. They would. But they didn't think about revolution. In Egypt, something similar happened in a very different register. Gamal Abdel Nasser, although he was a dictator, delivered the goods economically for a very big sector of the Egyptian people over a similar period of time, let's say from early 1950s up through 1965, just before the 1967 war. People's incomes increased, land was redistributed to peasants, a ceiling was put on rent for agricultural land. Egypt became a leader not only of the Arab world, but of the entire non-aligned movement. So people became proud of their country. And there was a dictatorship, and the communists were thrown in jail. But even from their jail, when the most communists were jailed from 1960 to 63, they supported the regime. It was a kind of ridiculous situation. So when they came out of jail, there was nothing. There was just nothing. And so everything that has appeared on the left in Egypt is new and weak and doesn't have any historical connection to anything. And there's this class problem that, take the revolutionary socialists. Well, you know, if five or six of them are my colleagues at American University in Cairo and another 20, 30 of them are graduates of American University in Cairo, those aren't people that hang out with workers, with one or two important exceptions, very important exceptions. So there's a class divide within the left that is no less sharp in Egypt than the class divide in the country as a whole. We don't have quite that problem in the United States because the traditional working class is shrinking and class divisions socially have not typically been that sharp since the, say, 1950s here. There's much more that could be said, but we're out of time, so we'll just leave it there.
The woman in the light blue jacket.
Choice or by international intervention, it was never given the opportunity to take care of its own internal affairs. If we want to compare at all, I mean, the Arab states would compare to the states here. And this is one country with its differences, but from what you said and what we know about the region, each country has its own political and economic forces. And then we look at the different axes in education, in religion, class structure, and we see that the bottom line is that the region does not have a legacy of organizing. You've mentioned that, which is very interesting. I mean, there's no legacy of democratic governance or running of internal affairs, political or economic. And then to go back to the women's issues and their participation, I was in Egypt last year in April, right after the start of the revolt, and I talked to highly educated Egyptian women, and they said, we don't know what to do. So my point is, and my question to you is, we know this is going to take a long time to unfold, but do you see any seeds of starting to organize in any way, like putting together the intellectuals with the youth, with the educated, with the rural population. It's very complex, I know. But do you see any seeds of any direction in the region?
I wouldn't, at this point, predict what direction. I mean, very contradictory things have happened over the last year or so. On the one hand, the fact that a revolt that began in Tunisia and Egypt then spread to so many other countries shows you that at one level, pan-Arabism is still alive, right? I mean, this is a pan-Arab phenomenon. And how did it get to be a pan-Arab phenomenon? Not as in the 50s and 60s where Nasser or the Ba'ath stood up and said, I'm the leader of the Arab world, follow me. No, it became a pan-Arab phenomenon because of Al Jazeera. There was an independent television station that is, first of all, broadcasting to everyone, more or less at the same time. So in real time, you can find out what happened, not from the regime's point of view. And just as importantly, they're broadcasting in modern standard Arabic. So all the regional dialects which people speak every day, I mean, people continue to speak. I mean, Moroccans don't understand Iraqis, I mean, not at all in terms of their local dialect, but they do understand, if they're educated, modern standard Arabic. So there's been a cultural pan-Arabism that's been reinforced as a result of Al Jazeera and similar phenomena. At the same time, look at how utterly, utterly awful and hopeless the Arab League has been about intervening in Syria. I mean, they're a total catastrophe. They're going to go back now to the Security Council where it's clear that nothing is going to happen. So, and they appointed this Sudanese butcher as the head of the military delegation they sent to observe, and he said everything is cool. You know, I mean, really, totally hopeless. So, as I said, things are moving in different directions at the same time. In terms of each country's individual situation and who is able to organize whom, well, we have to say the Islamists clearly have shown the best capacity so far. They have supporters who are workers, peasants, middle class. They even have supporters who are quite wealthy among the intelligentsia across the board. There are historic reasons why they've been able to do that, and they're slightly different in each country, but it shows you it can be done. So there's something to learn from them. The left has not succeeded in doing that. And women in particular have a problem. And the problem isn't Islam. I mean, that I think is bogus. Because Egypt has a 10% Christian minority. Christian women are not much better off than Muslim women. That's not the issue. The problem is patriarchy. And religion is used to justify patriarchy. But this is because of the history of actual imperialism and colonialism and cultural imperialism, which still continues. A word like feminism is a very suspicious word. There actually is no word for feminism in Arabic. There's no word for gender in Arabic. So these subjects are not able to be discussed freely by people who don't know English and French. We have a big problem there. I mean, people who do know English and French can talk about them, but then we're speaking about a small minority of the population. And so how are those people who do know English or French going to go and talk to peasant women, for example, in Egypt? Clitoridectomy is illegal, but the majority of the population still does it. So foreigners should stay out of that. But Egyptian women who are against the practices, it's their job to go and convince their fellow citizens that it's not good. This is very hard. I mean, there is this class difference. There's the people who would be more strongly against it would tend to be more secularly oriented. So there has been progress on issues like that. There's going to continue to be more. But again, we're at the beginning of a process which has not yet ended, and I don't have any capacity, and I don't think anybody does, to tell you what the end is going to be.
Folks, I'm going to give it to Joel to wrap up in just a second, but before I do, I just want to mention one thing. We have a book called Revolutionary Rehearsals that goes over workers' struggles in some other countries, such as Chile, Portugal, Iran, which you'll find very interesting in comparison to the information that Joel shared with us today. And we also have a great issue of ISR, International Socialist Review, titled The Global Food Revolt. And both of these are in room 294, which I think is on the other side of this wall right here, if not at the end of the hall. So please go check those out if you're interested. And Joel, would you wrap it up for us?
Sure. Since you just held up a copy of ISR, there's a recent issue of International Socialism, which is not quite the same thing, I guess, but it's the same tendency, I believe, which has an article by Ann Alexander on the Egyptian workers' movement and the 25th of January revolution. You can download the whole thing from the internet. I just did yesterday. Ann is one of the people. There are like three foreigners who have some clue what's going on in detail. Ann is one of them. And she, you can see from this both the dogmatism, but she also knows what's going on. So both sides. General conclusion. I think I was trying to be careful not to suggest that what is happening here are working class-led revolutions. First of all, I don't think in Egypt in particular we've even had a revolution. We've had the removal of the head of state. Most of the rest of the state apparatus is still in place, and in particular, the internal security and the judiciary. And those are the apparatuses that have been used to repress people throughout the year. So until those apparatuses are reformed, the police, the state security investigations, all of the judges who follow orders and don't judge by the law, until the Constitution is rewritten to be more democratic, and that's not going to be a simple thing, there's not we can't really talk about any kind of revolution. So, and Egypt in that sense is in the middle. Tunisia, I think there's been a more revolutionary change because there has been more dismantling of the previous state apparatus. Bahrain, obviously not, because the uprising was physically repressed, and Morocco, the king, outmaneuvered the democracy movement. So I want to underline that I was not trying to convey that these have been or are about to be soon workers-led revolutions. What I would and did say is that there was and continues to be an important economic and social dimension to these uprisings across the Arab world, and that that is caused by the increased poverty, the increased gap between the rich and the poor, the inflation, the national humiliation at the economic level, which is all due to the neoliberal economic restructuring of the region, which has gone on since the mid-1970s. Where that will end up, I am not prepared to say. Am I right? Is that the same tendency? I don't know.